Accession number 29075, reel number 5.
Graham Meredith, reel 5. Had you, by this stage, any specific ideas of a career path in terms of what you were wanting to do in the Navy?
Well, I mean, I had joined the Navy as a career. That was very much, of course, the approach of the whole of my generation and generations before. And although moments of doubt or reconsideration did occur later, at this point, certainly, things were going well and I was enjoying it. I was getting variety and responsibility. And I reckoned I was in much the most satisfactory job of any of my my contemporaries at school or whatever. You know, I thought things were going very well. So, you know, I wanted to do well in the Navy because you enjoy it more if you're doing dreary jobs. And but other than staying in the Navy for a full career, I hadn't any particular ideas.
And after your time as the Assistant Secretary to the Vice Chief of the Naval Staff, what happened next?
Well, then I was to go as the Captain Secretary in the Fishery Protection Squadron. I particularly asked for whatever job that would get me out of the ivory tower. I felt I wanted to go back to sea again. I had no idea what might come up, and this, to my great surprise, was what I was told to do. And I had a bit of time to prepare for that. I was sent off to look at the fishing industry a bit. Fish Guard and Hull. I went off on a trawling trip 3 weeks out, which was very very interesting. See, an entirely different way of life, and the people, of course, different. Right? We only had a crew of about 12 in this trawler, and they were all interesting, even if many of them came from a very rough background, and they were leading a very tough life. Anyway, so I learned about a bit about the fishing industry, and in I think September of 1960 I joined as the Captain Secretary in HMS Duncan. Duncan was a Type 14 frigate, the smallest frigates that we had built since the Second World War. Interestingly, they're all built in the 50s, and there were about 8 or 10 of them that we had, and they cost £1.25 million each. You can't even buy a smart yacht for that these days. And they were very effective ships for the way we were able to use them. They were marvellous as long-distance patrol ships. They were actually highly effective anti-submarine ships, as it turned out. They had 120 men, the crew all up, and the Navy was able to make very good use of them, and indeed of the coastal minesweepers as well, and they were the legacy of the naval staff of around 1950, when Admiral MacGregor was the first Sea Lord, I guess. And the Duncan was the first ship I'd ever been in where I had a cabin to myself. I'd always had a shared cabin before, if a cabin at all. And she got tossed around in the rough weather up in the northern latitudes, but it was she was a good little ship. And the Fishery Protection Squadron consisted of 4 of those Type 14s. Mine was driven by a captain, one was driven by a commander, And then there were two that were driven by lieutenant commanders, and they were the Duncan, the Malcolm, the Palliser, and the Russell. And then we had, I think, six coastal minesweepers and two inshore minesweepers as well in the squadron. The inshores were based down in the English Channel, based on Portland. We used to see them as often as we could, which wasn't probably enough. But the coastal minesweepers were all based at Port Edgar and Rosyth, the same as we were. And from this little ship, the captain of the squadron, with a very small staff, he had a staff officer operations and a secretary, and a chief yeoman of signals and a couple of sailors. And with that, we ran the operational end of the Cod War with Iceland. And for that, we had ships detached to us from the home fleet, and then they went up and they patrolled the Icelandic waters, where the Icelanders were claiming a 12-mile limit, which was based on really rather phony baselines going from major headland to major headland. And it was all the doctrines within international law, and that's what we, Britain, were arguing against. Firstly, the 12-mile limit at all, but then going across huge bays rather than across fairly small bays. And the Icelanders were thereby trying to enclose large areas of sea which were important to our fishing industry. And, as we regarded it, important as a national, an international philosophy, really, so that the sea became an international resource as much as possible, which is the way the international law of the sea had been drawn up. Not too much was made of it, but the logic of our position was somewhat undermined by a treaty that we had entered into with the Tsars of Russia in about 1905 or thereabouts, where we had acknowledged a 12-mile territorial sea for Russia, and in return were given access to a very good stretch of coast along North Russia into 3 miles. You know, this was a part, and this treaty was still valid and being enforced when I was in the Fishery Protection Squadron. But we had conceded the 12-mile point, you know, long before in one case. But our ships, we tended to have 3 frigates at a time up on patrol off Iceland, and then of course we of the Fishery Protection Squadron were part of that, and this went on. It started in 1958, I think. I joined in 1960, and it went on until probably the summer of 61, but the history books will confirm the date, and then we basically conceded to the Icelanders, and we started to make peace. And navy to navy, or navy to coast guard, because that's the Icelanders have a coast guard, not a real navy. Relationships had remained pretty good despite this all the way through, but we were able to build on that when, in the Duncan, we paid the first of the visits into port. We went into Reykjavik, and some of the press was pretty anti, but actually the Icelandic Coast Guard and Icelandic officials were fine. We paid it as a low-key visit, but it was, of course, it did not go unnoticed. And from there, over through 61 and into 62, the general temperature came down to normal again. And we, our coastal minesweepers did all the fishery patrols around the UK. It was a good experience, actually.
How closely would you work with the fishing ships themselves, or representatives
fishing
of the fisheries?
Yeah. Well, we worked very closely with the trawlers, and we were often having skippers of trawlers or whatever over to, you know, to talk and that sort of thing. We had we paid visits to the main fishery ports, both as whole ships or going down by train to, you know, to have meetings for particular purposes. I failed to mention that we did have an office in Port Edgar, which is South Queen's Ferry, and that had a lieutenant commander in it, who was our sort of standing man. He was the closest direct and always available link for the fishing industry. But we had quite a bit to do with the fishermen, and we're always chatting to them on the radio, of course, when we were on patrol.
Was there actually much real threat to the British fishing vessels from the Icelandic fleet?
Well, only, yeah, not a huge threat, but yes, I mean, some of them did get arrested just occasionally. When we our blocking tactics had not succeeded, but it wasn't a serious threat. Much the more serious threat was from the Danes in the Faroes, because there was the Danish had a fishery protection squadron, which was led by a ship called the Niels Ebbing, and whose captain was the Captain Serling. And Captain Serling was clearly quite belligerent, and we met him on various occasions, and he was talking about putting a shot through the funnel, you know, in order to warn people off. Well, he did make a good try at that in one case, and he set off in chase after an Aberdeen trawler called the Red Crusader. And he chased her all the way to Aberdeen and failed to catch her. And he did fire at her a few times. And that then led to an international tribunal at The Hague, where the British team was led by the Attorney General, Manningham Buller. And I was involved with that quite a lot, particularly in briefing and that sort of thing. But that was the only real, I think, gunfire incident. There may have been a bit of a shooting incident, but not of a shoot to sink, except when Captain Serling was around. The Icelanders, it was shot across the bows type of thing.
Did you have a specific set of rules of engagement?
Oh, yes. I can't remember the detail, but...
And presumably you were also protecting UK waters from...
Yes, well, that was done by these coastal minesweepers mostly. Yes, we did operate in UK waters a bit, ready to give ourselves a break. But, yes, we still have, I'm sure, a lot of restrictions on fishery... within UK waters. We don't let our own fishermen fish in them because they're good breeding grounds and that sort of thing. In those days, there was still a big herring fishery in the North Sea. Now that's virtually disappeared. And, well, we were trying to keep Belgians and Poles and the like out of our territorial waters and our own fishermen out of our prohibited areas. And that was done mostly by the coastal minesweepers we had.
This was for 2 years, was it?
Yes, I did a full 2 years doing this job. And then after that I came back to Greenwich for a course known as the Supply and Secretariat Advanced Course, And I think it was the very last of that particular one that I did, and then reinvented it and put it down to Chatham. But that was a pleasant, an informative interlude, prepared one for a bit more senior jobs, both from a staff, you know, Admiral staff's point of view, and from being supply officer of a ship. And that lasted just 3 months, and then after that I went to the Flag Officer Air Home, as it was then called, who subsequently became Flag Officer Naval Air Command, at Leon Sovet. And I had a succession of jobs, initially as the Secretary to the Chief of Staff, and then that we reorganised, I became the Secretary to the Captain Air, and then we had two rear admirals also on the staff. The Flag Officer Air Home himself was a Vice Admiral, and we had two rear admirals, one engineer and one supply officer. The supply officer was the Rear Admiral Personnel, and he pinched me to be his secretary after I'd been there about 5 or 6 months or something. And then I had basically another nearly 2 years either with him or his successor. And that was really all the personnel policy, but also all the buildings, the administrative organisation of the Air Command.
And this was something you enjoyed?
Enough. It was not the most enjoyable job. It was too desk-bound and inactive, really, for me. But parts of it were interesting. One thing was that the first of the Rear Admiral's S that I had became very soon the Chief Naval Supply and Secretariat Officer. Well, that meant that he was dealing with wider things about supply work over the whole of the Navy, particularly a lot of personnel matters, promotions and promotion policy and that sort of thing. So my job expanded with it to be involved supporting him in doing that. But that was more interesting. But I got married while I was there at Leon Sovet, so I had rival attractions as well.
Did the break from being aboard ship allow a more normal private life, as it were?
Oh, yes. It became a thoroughly normal private life, except that one had to do duties rather more regularly than one would have to if one was working in a bank or a solicitor's office or working as a salesman. But it was a very normal life, and we were very happy. It was a good start to married life, as far as I was concerned.
Were you at the position when you were promoted?
No, I was not doing that when I... I became a lieutenant commander while I was in that job, yes. And I was promoted lieutenant commander after 8 years as a lieutenant in those days. There is now a selective system giving some people accelerated promotion to lieutenant commander. But we had to flog the 8 years. It became pretty boring by the end of it, as you were looking forward to the pay rise that came with the extra half stripe. But promotion made absolutely no difference whatever, either to my job or the way I did it or to my duties. But then, of course, it came with the opportunities that came after that. And my next job, I went off to sea to be the supply officer of HMS Cleopatra. Now, she was a new frigate, building in Devonport Dockyard, and I joined her what was supposed to be about a month before her contractor sea trials. It turned out to be about 4 months before her contractor sea trials, and because she was delayed. She was the last but one warship to be built in Devonport Dockyard, and that was an interesting experience. I'd been in ships refitting before, but had not been involved myself in sort of getting the dockyard productivity to deliver. Now I was getting much involved. it was interesting. And one was creating a new organisation, and I was lucky with the first of the team that I had, the senior ratings who were joining me, and we got a sensible, actually I think very good organisation going, and we went to contractor sea trials where the ship is normally sails under the Red Ensign, but as we had an RN captain in commander in command for it, we sailed under the White Ensign, and that was a bit of a drama all round because we broke down too regularly. And anyway, eventually we were commissioned in, I would think, towards the end of March of 66, that would be, yes. And we then went to Portland. My job there was not only being the supply officer, I was also the flight deck officer, which was good fun. That was something to get away from a desk. Although sometimes you might find yourself with an embarrassing amount of money lying around and you'd you've got to suddenly leap out and say hello to a new helicopter that was buzzing in. But I enjoyed that, and I'd done some training on it. Of course, from my time when I was with 848 Squadron, I knew quite a bit about helicoptering generally, and it was certainly an extra dimension. And when we had our work up in Portland, me and my gang on the flight deck, we were the only people who weren't a pallid white, because everybody else was down inside looking in ops rooms and that sort of boiler rooms and things like that. We were up in the sun. We had a very very good weather virtually throughout our workup. And then after the workup, we went out to the Far East, where we went all over the place in the Far East. And we're out there for a year, which included a long spell of Barra patrol, which it was because of the Six-Day War between Israel and Egypt, and I think it was the Six-Day War, and we had a very long stint because other ships had been taken away to go to sort of protect our interests for that, and we had 9 weeks or a bit more on Barra patrol, which is a long, long time. But you settle down into a routine. It's no worse than being on a Polaris patrol.
Does joining a new ship make it difficult to have a sense of, I suppose, the ship spirit?
Yeah, well, you try and build it up. If you've been lucky, as I had, to be in several happy ships, effective ships, then that is what you're trying to replicate. And it's largely achieved through personal relationships and efficiency. And people know when they're being efficient. When they know they're not being efficient, it's bad for their morale. And it's largely the personal relationships that you have with your own team, so that you are leading them, not driving them, and indeed then with the others, in the wardroom, one's own level of colleagues and that sort of thing. In this case of the Cleopatra, the heads of department. And we did all get on. It doesn't say we don't argue about something, but you mustn't let these things become personal. And if a decision goes against you, well, okay, you get on with it, and maybe you'll win the next one. don't have too many of them there.
Does the lack of history have any impact, or is there any issue on the...
No, I mean, you do have a history, even in a new ship, from the previous one of that name. You've got various trophies and that sort of thing, and the bits of legend, you find that the old war horses from the old ship come and tell you about her and that sort of thing. Not that that happened a huge amount for the Cleopatra. But we had a good liaison with the town of Harrogate, which had raised money. The town of Harrogate in the Second World War had raised the money to build the old Cleopatra. And so they asked if they could adopt us. And we established a good relationship there with them. And those sorts of things all add to the spirit that you build up in a ship. But it's really the people who are crucial to it. But they do need to realise that they are doing a good job, they're being efficient, and then their confidence builds up and they can do anything.
And the character of the ship herself, as a new ship, presumably fairly modern.
Yes, well, she was a Leander-class frigate, very near the end of that Leander building programme. And we always reckoned that she was probably the best finished of the lot, because we'd had these extra months when various parts of the machinery and so on weren't working well. You were able to get shipwrights making things really good. And also, the thing is, not sort of making them redo jobs, but able to be involved in getting the right answer. I think as time has gone on, much less personality of the original officers goes into a ship there, because there's a lot of control of the design and delivery and that sort of thing. So ships are very much more standard than they are by, to the ordinary eye. The Leanders were all standard, but there were actually quite a few sort of tweak type of differences.
And do you have to then learn more about coping with the engines and handling and so forth in a new ship?
Well, yes, I mean, a new ship would take, on the whole, it's fairly much the... related to one's earlier experience in other ships. But yes, when you first go off to sea, one of the first things the captain does is to, with wide open ocean, he starts trying to handle her and see whether she misbehaves in particular ways. Fortunately, the Cleopatra didn't. But although what happened, when we were out in the Far East, the diesel generators we had, which are the ones that generated electric power for when we were in harbour, because normally we were on turbo generators which were run down by the main engines, the diesel generators were mounted forward, pretty much under the line of the bridge, and one of them suddenly had a critical failure, came to a grinding halt, and was never going to go again. So we went into Singapore Dockyard, and we were due to have a docking to scrape the bottom anyway, so that was done. And meanwhile, we waited for a new diesel generator to arrive. Now, this was a huge thing. I mean, about 10 feet long, I suppose 8 or 12 cylinders, and it's really heavy machinery. And it necessitated cutting the ship's side on the port side, and then installing rails and sliding the thing out. Big snag was, just before we actually got into the dockyard for this, the other diesel generator went. Same problem. In both cases, the crankshafts had cracked right way across, just in two. And so we had to have both of them out. Anyway, because the ship's side had been cut on the port side, the ship suddenly became a bit like a banana. And so she was never straight from there on, and so ship handling was just a bit different, but it wasn't hugely so. But she kept that right through to the end. And her last captain was a friend of mine before she went to razor blades. And, yeah, still had the problem.